So the 50s was the age of this sort of, you know, golden age of capitalism, where mass production created competitive advantage, and that's what drove the economy. By the 70s, this structure wasn't working because there was a lot of resistance to it, and we had some new inventions. One was monetarism, where they controlled the economy by, you know, releasing the supply of money so that that could be floated more or less. And the other, process would have been post-Fordism as a way of economic production. Post-Fordism simply means you gain competitive advantage by using information economy to say where your product is. Instead of having everything in one factory and it's simple, you build it in 12 different factories in different countries, and you organize your marketing in somewhere else, your finance somewhere else. So if you take out your mobile phone is probably built, you know, this chip was built in Korea, and the packaging was done in Germany, and the marketing was done in, the finance was done in London, the marketing was done in Scandinavia, you know, this chip was built in some other country in East Asia, and so they find they can get competitive advantage by getting the cheapest labor in this country, the cheapest information knowledge economy work to put the phone together in this country, cheapest finance from, you know, this city, and that's sort of post-Fordism. So when you, a good way to understand, you know, neoliberalism is that it's an ideology that says we want a free market, and part of that free market is the structures use post-Fordism so they can be flexible with economy, which means they're flexible with your job. Monetarism is the control of the money supply. Originally you had a gold standard, so a country's would normally in past centuries have been on the gold standard unless there was war. And so when you come off the gold, all the paper money you print has some gold bullion to back it up. If you take out your 10-pound note today, you look at it and it says it'll entitle the bearer to 10 pounds, 10 pounds of sterling, and that was originally meant something because you could go to the bank and get 10 pounds of bullion. In the 70s, they got rid of that, sometimes there's more money out there than represents the real value in the world. And Jimmy Carter was one of the first people to do that. It was coming through the economy, and Reagan, of course, Thatcher, hugely involved in, you know, creating that sort of monetarist system. And basically the monetarist policy by, say, in the UK and most central banks in Europe and America, Mervyn King is the head of the Bank of England, has been to fix policy of so that you don't have inflation for your for food and your sort of basic staples that working class people need. And so it seems like there's not inflation in the economy. But in fact, your other things, the money supply is increasing, whereas the amount of value that is made, normally value is associated with the amount of labor that is put into work. So if you build a new car, that's more value because there's a new car. I mean, you may argue that it's not the right type of value. We want a public transportation system rather than the private, you know, fossil fuel transportation system. But increasing value. So if we have, an increase in value in the world, say, like, stock market, they trade stocks and your money goes up. You have increase, like, say, financial bubbles where there's more trading in money in the world than the value of the actual stocks that are there. So this huge bubble is growing up. And one of the reasons you can see that is the price of property, right? If there's more money in the world, but there's not actually much more value in the world, then what are rich people who have all that money going to say? Some of them are going to say, great, I've got this money. And others are going to say, well, money, that's cool, but I want to actually get hold of something that's valuable. And most people go to property. So property prices were a huge bubble, you know, increasing and increasing. You know, does the value of your house increase because the price of it has doubled? Well, the value of your house is just what you can do with it. So that's monetarist policy was set in the 70s too.
I just want to stop here. Does anyone else have any? Does anyone have any questions there?
Just another one. the road, couldn't get in.
Does anyone have any questions?
Here's a copy of what I just went over.
No.
I did?
Yeah, I think it was reading somewhere where it says, an article on neoliberalism is dead. But the neoliberalism is the line between market economics, and that's the backbone of capitalism. Right? And obviously, for neoliberalism to be dead, if you get the line of conclusion, then capitalism has to be dead. But as you say, it's a sexting crisis. But one of my things I find that if you look through history, you always see that, you know, they intervene, you know, through Keynesianism, you call it state capitalism.
Yeah.
The intervention at different times, at different periods of times. And even now, with the financial crisis and stuff, you see the intervention again. But have no doubt, that is just a tactic. That's a tactic to try and stabilise the system as it is at the minute. And if you look at the last 30 years, even in Britain, you see the manufacturing industry going down the tube, but that was replaced with financial industry and the high flyers. Now, we're talking about moving from the financial industry, trying to still keep it stabilised, but trying to bring in more high-tech jobs for those at the top, while for those at the bottom, like the call centres and stuff, and at the same time, selling off different industries, but in the longer term, buying them, nationalising them, state capitalism, but in the longer term, to sell them back where they want it to be for profit. So the system itself, you know, has that history of knowing how to tinker during crisis, and I think they're ready to say it's an opportunity for them. It's an opportunity now, they believe, is to try and stabilise it, to push it further ahead and to try and bring the free market economics into a wider milieu and bring more of the developing countries into the fold at the same time as well. But that was an excellent speech, really, really interesting.
Does anyone else have anything to add? By the way,
didn't hear it.
John's got it all recorded so you can listen to it on the internet.
Go ahead.
Well, like, for example, in South America and places like that, there's been a kind of dead socialism that failed during the Cold War thanks to America, who wanted to ensure neoliberalism. But like, recently they've had solidarity movements, like equivalent to the Polish one, but theirs have always been Catholic, etc. But they've managed to take back factories. What do you think is the solution for European workers to do that in the face of neoliberalism? Why they haven't resorted to those kind of tactics?
I got one in the other night.
Well, I mean, obviously we need to help, you know, fighting working class movements. People need to, like, make sure that the environmental movement is not simply about, you know, sort of the aesthetics of the environment, like, oh, we'd like to keep our planet. It's also about making sure that the people who are disproportionately profiting from capitalist production that, you know, have to pay for the external costs of that, which is environmental destruction. I think it's also they have to resist the securitization state. Another response to by, you know, the state, the rich people who are on the top of the end of the economy is say, well look, we've banjaxed the system, a lot of people are going to be out in the streets being upset with us, we need a greater levels of security. So resisting things like ID cards is an important part of you know, a global process where people link social justice issues together. That's one of the, those are a couple of the ways we can work on those issues. Just in response to what Davey said, I think there's a, in terms of like the neoliberal project, the neoliberal ideology really said that there was no, pretended that there was never any state intervention, as if somehow the state wasn't there, and the free market was, I mean, the true neoliberal ideologue would have said, let's get rid of the state, and we just have free market capitalism running everything. And the state was always involved in neoliberalism. It had minimum regulations to, you know, the ideal state for the neoliberalist, like it's a perfect capitalist. It makes sure that capitalism doesn't fight itself, but it benefits you know, regulating the economy. Today, you've suddenly seen neoliberalism wasn't able to uphold that kind of thing, and they have to put huge amounts of state intervention to prop up the economy, to prop up the banking system, to prop up the ability for money to circulate. You know, whether people will come and say, yes, we want to, you know, to keep state state intervention? Probably not. They'll probably try to reprivatize all those banking issues. And anyways, the privatization that's happened has really been state capitalism, because they haven't, you know, they own the banks. They're not doing it as nationalization for working people. They're doing it as just propping up the banks with working people's money, but not benefiting working people. The other approach, of course, the Keynesianism of the 30s, was much more like had nationalization, where the banks were controlled, and there was some benefit for, you know, with the big state projects, there was some benefit for working people, nationalized industries. There was some benefit in that for working people, and that was because working class people fought in the 30s and forced that issue.
I think there's one thing we haven't touched upon here, which is in the north we have the gradual shift from the state economy to the private economy. At the minute we have about a third of industry rely on the state, whereas you can see the gradual shift which is continuing. Would you define it as a neoliberal shift? For example, recently the Ministers of Stormont announced a new repackaging of the private finance initiatives and the public-private partnerships and education sector also. I think we still have a gradual shift in this economy here.
Public-private finance is an example of neoliberalism, where you use the government, you pretend the government isn't involved, but you use the government to pass rules and say, look, here's the water supply of Northern Ireland, and we're going to, you know, the government's going to take most of the risks and pay huge amounts of money, but eventually the profits will be shifted into the private sector. So that, after the World Trade Organization, you know, was hoping to push a GATS agreement, General Agreement on Trades and Services, trade in services, so all your public services were identified by the neoliberals as the new way to make money. Let's control that. And mostly public services have always been run by the state. All of those are there. The state's always been involved in the shift, and I think they're largely, those kind of projects haven't been taken apart yet. They're still trying to hold that on together. So that's another example of continuing to push neoliberalism as an ideology and a belief, the market system.
But the public sector here was a necessity of the state over the last 30 years because of the conflicts. Okay. It was within their interest. And you've seen the new government set up in the centre-right governance, and obviously they're going to push it towards, it's a PFI, privatisation, etc. But that is replicated around the world. You know what I mean? Any time that the ruling powers, you know, want to get into a country, a country's been developed, trying to move forward, they will intervene and they will push them to the right. And that's the reality of the system. They've learned so much, you know, the ruling powers have learned so much throughout history, and at the end of the day, you know, they will tinker with it, and they will tinker with it, they will use it as an opportunity. Crisis, they'll use it as an opportunity, as you said yourself, and at the end of the day, the only way of moving forward and trying to get a better society is through the politics of working class, you know, coming to the streets and taking the floor. But you were saying earlier on, like, there's many different, about Latin America, you know, there's many different tactics used around the world, you know what I mean, but it's the same type of strategy. You know, it is the working class people who have to take it to the floor and take it to the streets. You know, small struggles are as important as large struggles at the end of the day, and they replicate all around the world in different communities. So I think there's a lot of lessons that the ruling class has learned, mm-hmm. but there's a lot of lessons that we learn as the working class to try and achieve a society that we think will be beneficial for the working class globally around the world.
But all struggles start from grassroots. Mm-hmm. Every single struggle starts from grassroots. And if you don't get the grassroots struggles, you don't get anything. Otherwise, it's just a dictatorship. Mm-hmm. And I think that for 30 years here, that's what we have put up with, mm-hmm. a dictatorship, because our grassroots have been so fragmented mm-hmm. that we don't have a good grassroots base here for change. I'm just back in Guatemala, where I did notice a really big grassroots change in their attitude to the indigenous people, where, like, the last time I was in Venezuela, Guatemala, Honduras was doing work after their horrendous civil wars. Three of them had this awful period of civil war, and there was no grassroots movements at all. It was just Spanish rule in Guatemala. Mm-hmm. End of. If you weren't Spanish, you didn't get a job, you didn't get working, you didn't get
education, you wouldn't get anything.
Like the Zapatistas in Mexico? Oh, right, yeah.
Just exactly the same. So, like, I noticed an incredible different change, but it was all very, very small organizations. I went around with 50 small organizations, 30 people, 40 people, 50 people. They were really making a big change, economical change in their own environment. And they were doing it themselves because, I mean, like Spanish will, you know, like, they just will not let them get their head above the, like, to chop it up at every turn. And I think it, in this country, we're not any different. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's no such a thing as the privatised. The government here propped up the privatised industry as well. There's nobody came into Northern Ireland 10, 20, 30, 40 years ago that were not propped up by government money to come in here.
Yeah.
They were paid to come in here. So they came in here with a very different agenda than they would of other countries, you know.
Mm-hmm. I think it's a great way to look at the peace process as in some ways as a project for neoliberalism. Was really, it's too expensive to, you know, Northern Ireland is too expensive, and they probably, most of them would like to just parcel off Northern Ireland to a United Ireland, just because it would be easier for global capitalism to manage the exploitation of workers if Northern Ireland was it was part of Ireland. And the lack of grassroots is structured by fiscal policy, right? So basically you give a lot of NGOs money, here's some money, and they don't organize themselves. So people get free money, they don't work hard. If you're a grassroots movement, you're if you have a purpose and a resource base, you know, if your purpose is let's deal with the underlying problems, and the problem happens to be the government, your resource base is you get money from the government, well, then you're going to be in a clash. You're either going to make a decision to go with your purpose, find new resources, or you're going to go with the funding. And that's a lot of times is what's happened in here. And so that the long-term solution for capitalism was let's push a peace process. And you see, and very cynically, you can look at the peace process as, let's get one group of men to stop shooting another group of men so that we can get back to building new buildings and sell things in the center of the city, right? But outside, in the rest of Belfast, you see working class communities that are still dealing with the devastation of violence. Long-term effects of the war are things like violence against women as a huge legacy. But the peace process didn't really involve that. It dealt with, let's just get enough things together so we can get these men to stop shooting at each other, we can go back to business in Northern Ireland.
Can I just bring in Davey here, and then I know we're stuck for time. We wanted at the start to discuss the recent events in Belfast, you know, the racist attacks and all. So, I don't know, we'll bring in Davey, and then we'll
devote
a bit of time towards that.
I just say I disagree with your analysis. You know, there is a difference between grassroots movements here and, you know, next to Latin America, but the history of here has shown that there has been real important, significant grassroots movement. There has been from civil rights, housing, through the war, racism against sectarians from the bottom. But the problem lies is whenever it comes under the control of different groups and different organisations, which you say is like a dictatorship. But there has been huge history here of people spontaneously coming onto the streets and grassroots, spontaneously defending the communities, spontaneously picking, occupying factories, occupying homes, everything. So there has been those movements, those history, which is very, very important to understand the dress, but the lessons we have to draw from them is that a lot of them have been put in and brought under the control, under the remit, which is in the interest of whatever organisation at the time, but also it always moved from a left wing over to a right wing agenda eventually. So it's important to understand that history, to learn from that history, to ensure that those actions that we can actually keep it and try and win the arguments to keep it in the left wing direction and keep it open. You know, people have, you know, open discussions like this, where there isn't a ruling elite, you know, who dictate it down. It has to come from below, like you says, from the start. And you have to learn lessons how you keep it at the grassroots rather than dictate it from above.
That's a lesson that was learned from the civil rights movement. I was in the civil rights movement. I mean, I was in Newry, I was in Derry, I was anywhere the civil rights movements were. The lesson I learned from all of my work over the years, and then a long time working in grassroots, that I have learned was as soon as money came into it, it became political. and then you lost that wonderful spontaneous movement. Mm-hmm. Let's apply for funding. Was my biggest dread. You know, once the funding came in, then I had to go political.
I would say you're 100% right, but I would say also as well as money. You know, money influences, but it's also political influence.
They
were able to get political influence from moving things from one direction to another. They did it as well. So there's different situations depending on what grassroots people are organisation we were talking about.
Maybe civil rights movement would be a good one for another time.
Would do.
A talk on the history of the civil rights movement, like lessons learned. Okay, I don't know. So